Now, detonate the reality bomb!
Jesus Christ, you're a man.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know, catapults of propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
I'm reading a book on the history of the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency by investigative reporter Annie Jacobson. And in reading some of the lessons that were learned during the war in Vietnam, it has become apparent that we are repeating some very similar mistakes currently in our adventures in the Middle East. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert, and our guest has written an article that caught my attention because it tracks with what I've been thinking and wanted to bring him on to discuss this. He is the author of 10 books. Most recently, Is Russia Destined to Nuke the U.S.? He's a featured speaker at the 2016 Rocky Mountain International Prophecy Conference in Colorado Springs. His new article is titled, Pick Your Poison, The U.S. Can't Win in Syria. It's our honor to welcome our friend Doug Woodward back to the program. Doug, I think you've hit the nail right on the head here.
Well, thank you. The issues that are going on right now that are playing out in the Middle East and Syria are enormously strategic. And frankly, from my point of view, in terms of where this is leading, it almost makes everything else that we are, you know, interested in talking about, almost makes everything else pale in comparison because it has the big implications for our nation.
Yeah. This week we learned that a master sergeant in U.S. Special Forces from our home state here of Missouri was killed in a raid in northern Iraq. He and his team were leading a group of Kurdish forces. They were advisors, supposedly, to rescue some 70 people who were apparently in imminent danger of being executed. Graves had already been dug for these people, we are told. And during the firefight, the Kurdish forces began taking losses. And so he became the first American casualty in ground fighting in Iraq in years. So that situation hasn't gone away. And meanwhile, over next door in Syria, the Islamic State has entrenched itself to the point that a year's worth of aerial bombardment by the United States Air Force, arguably the most powerful air force on the planet, has not seriously degraded their capabilities. I mean, to the point where intelligence analysts for CENTCOM, U.S. CENTCOM, are complaining that their reports have been changed going up the chain of command to say what the White House wants to hear. And this is what was happening during the Vietnam War. The intelligence analysis of people on the ground saying, you know, we're losing the battle for the hearts and minds of the people on the ground here. They don't like us. They don't like what we're doing, and they're going to support her. And all of that was changed to fit the narrative that was being fed to the American people. 50 years later, same or very similar, anyway, errors. And then, of course, Vladimir Putin changed the calculus on the ground by putting Russian troops and airplanes in Syria to back Bashar Assad, and suddenly the game has changed. What do you see happening, and where do we go from here?
Well, there are a lot of things going on. I think probably the first major headline, of course, over the last 30 days has been Russia's incursion into the Middle East. Yes, they were there before in Tartus, the Syrian port on the Mediterranean, but the Russians have beefed up their commitment with about three dozen airplanes, fighters, and fighter bombers, at least a 10 or more of their tanks, not their newest generation, but still fairly state-of-the-art tanks. And so an additional naval warships. They've even gone so far as to demonstrate, effort in Syria to demonstrate that they have the ability to fire cruise missiles from over 1,000 miles away.
Yeah, from the Caspian Sea.
Exactly, from the Caspian Sea to hit targets. Never mind the fact that the first few targets hit in outside, you know, sort of any city area in Iran. So they sort of misfired, but they finally figured out how to shoot their cruise missiles, and they actually hit targets 1,000 miles away in Syria. So you've got that kind of thing going on. So anyway, you've got a major effort on the part of the Russian military to exert its influence in Syria. And it's calling into question what really has been the American strategy. Who is it that we are working with in Syria and Iraq to try to defeat ISIS, and whether or not defeating ISIS is in fact our real objective.
Yeah.
Whether our real objective is just a regime change, and we really don't want to necessarily wipe out ISIS in the process.
Yeah, it's 4 years on since President Obama said that our goal in Syria was to get rid of Bashar Assad. 4 years later, he's still there. 250,000 Syrians are dead. 4.5 million Syrians have been displaced and run out of their homes. And the Christian communities in Syria, some of the oldest in the world, have basically been demolished. For the first time since the time of the apostles, there are no Christians in the ancient city of Nineveh, which is Mosul. Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister of Russia, made the kind of snide remark that maybe the American pilots aren't trying very hard to explain why the air campaign hasn't been successful so far. But one of the things that's really, you know, and this is something that makes me pull out my hair, is that with all of the political capital that the Republican Party is spending on the Benghazi investigation and calling Hillary Clinton to Congress to answer for what she knew and when she knew it and what did the president know and so on and so forth about the deadly attack on September 11th of 2012 in Benghazi, Libya. Nobody's brought up the fact that what we were doing there, and apparently what Ambassador Chris Stevens was doing, was overseeing the transfer of weapons from the disbanded Libyan army to the rebels in Syria. Rebels who included Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the group that the Defense Intelligence Agency later said, we need to quit sending these guys weapons because they're going to turn, they're going to create an independent Islamic State in Syria and Iraq with devastating, destabilizing consequences for both nations. And lo and behold,
it happened.
But that didn't come up during the conversation with Secretary Clinton.
Yeah, it's ironic because the Congress essentially is doing its best to try to hurt Hillary Clinton's chances for becoming president of the United States, and so they seem to be focused on that. But the real issue, I mean, that Benghazi obviously is old news, and the sinister nature of what was really being done then is not necessarily the fact that we weren't protecting, in effect, our embassy, but that we were already at that time funneling weapons into Syria and into Iraq to support rebel groups that were, our intention was that they would overthrow or pressure out of office Bashar al-Assad. Mm-hmm. And the question is, well, why were we doing that?
Exactly.
Well, the general statement is, well, because they're a murderous dictator, totalitarian, autocratic regime. Well, that may be true. It is, in fact, true. But the real reason probably has more to do with, in effect, a U.S.-Russia proxy war, and the fact that Syria has been an ally to Russia and formerly the Soviet Union for decades. And it is more likely that we were playing a bigger game that the American public really was not being kept informed about. And so, in effect, the fact that we had created ISIS, an Islamic State, or the attempt to create a caliphate across the Fertile Crescent of the northern portions of the Middle East, you know, it's never really come out that we had ulterior motives. And so when it finally became clear to the Russians that they actually had a threat themselves they would have to deal with because of the growth and the impact of ISIS in Iraq and in Syria, that they better do something about it themselves. Otherwise, that revolution could come back into southern portions of what used to be called the Soviet Union, and into Kyrgyzstan and all these different stands, as I like to call mm-hmm. them, in Eurasia, and they could be looking at a very big problem on their own turf.
Yeah, when we look at a map of the area there and look north of Syria and Iran and Turkey, where they sort of meet right there, the Kurdish regions, due north of there, you've got the nations of Armenia and Azerbaijan, which have basically been spoiling for a fight with each other for decades. But north of that is Georgia. And, of course, we remember just a few years ago where the breakaway region of Georgia, Ossetia, was the flashpoint for a brief war between Russia and Georgia.
Yes.
And, of course, just north of there is a territory within Russia called Chechnya, where the Russians have had their hands full for a long time. How has the that revolution that the Russians had to put down in Chechnya impacted Putin's decision to go into Syria, do you think?
Well, I think it's had a very direct impact. I think that he's very conscious that he has an enormous Muslim population in his country and in the countries that are part of the sort of the new Russian Federation. You might help me remember the name of the economic group that it comprises. But nevertheless, he's very aware that he's got a lot more Muslims that he has to deal with in his country, and that they are quiet, but they won't stay quiet necessarily forever. Chechnya, of course, was a huge issue for Russia to deal with, and it was the source of all kinds of charges and countercharges, false flag operations, and whatnot. But not getting too far afield, this issue is one that threatens Russia. And so I was reading an article yesterday by someone that covers the Near East, as they call it. And, their sense was that Russia has accomplished more in about 3 weeks than the U.S. has accomplished in 3 years. And the reason is because the U.S. was not really wanting to eliminate ISIS. The U.S. was merely wanting to use it as a point of pressure to try to get Assad to force a regime change. And one of the points, big points that I make in the article and in a subsequent article I've done called The Great Reversal, is that all of a sudden we are seeing the Soviets are deciding, not the Soviets, the Russians. I'll do that probably several times. and there's probably, it's kind of a Freudian slip in a way, but
sure.
Yeah, but anyway, that they are supporting totalitarian autocratic regimes such as Assad or Assad, and they're doing that because they can actually take the moral high ground. They can say, look, people would prefer to live in an autocratic state, even if the regime is vicious, than to live in total chaos. And their accusation is that the U.S. has a policy, covert operations by the CIA, that our real intention is to keep the Middle East and North Africa and any of the other states that are in the region of Eurasia, to keep them in disarray and in tumult, that we prefer to have it that way because we don't want there to be an opportunity for Russia to obtain the kind of power status that it once had. And we want our military-industrial complex to be able to sell weapons to both sides and so forth and so on. And so you can get into some really extensive conspiracy theories, but the point you made earlier, that you alluded to earlier, the book Legacy of Ashes talks about this extensively, the history of the CIA, the covert operations, the fact that the U.S. has attempted to throttle back on revolutions. But the great reversal is that here the U.S. seems to want to create revolution, or to allow Islam to actually create revolution, states or regions, as a way of keeping Russia tied down and focused on issues like Chechnya, and like Syria and, you know, like all of the states that are immediately surrounding Russia.
Ukraine.
And the Ukraine, absolutely, which I've written about extensively as
yes.
well.
Yeah.
And so it is to keep Russia in a state of anxiety with all of this, with all of the border states around it in great turmoil. It would be the same for us as if Canada to our north and Mexico to our south were having enormous revolutions or wars, and we were worried about that bleeding over. To some extent, we see that, of course, mm-hmm. in the drug issues at our south, at Laredo and El Paso and other places. But that's really what you know. Many are arguing that we have no intention of taking ISIS out, that the aid that we've been providing to the so-called moderate Serbian rebel force is in fact really flowing through to al-Nusra, which is Syria's al-Qaeda.
Right.
So in fact, the U.S. has really been funding directly or indirectly funding al-Qaeda as a way to fight against ISIS, but not to the point where it really wants either to be destroyed. In fact, it really wants these rebel groups to be powerful enough, again, to put pressure and to try to force a regime change. And so that appears to be behind the scenes what the real play is that's been going on. Now, whether or not the White House is being kept fully informed of what's really happening, or that happens to be a convenient excuse to give the president plausible deniability, you know, that's another question. But that seems to be what's going on right now.
Yeah, it has always struck me as difficult to accept that our government and those who are advising the president and advising our State Department, advising the military, are really so clueless about the situation in the Middle East that this developed by accident, that we and clearly because of the documents obtained by Judicial Watch, the DIA document I referenced earlier that warned against continuing to supply al-Qaeda in Iraq in 2012 indicates that what they're telling us they're trying to accomplish isn't really what they're trying to accomplish. In other words,
that's right.
I find it more difficult to believe that our government and our military and are run by a bunch of idiots than to believe that they're just not telling us the truth.
Yeah. Well, there's always the real strategic question is our government dominated by sinister evil, or is it dominated by incompetence?
Yeah. Yeah.
And the reality is that it's some of both.
And I'm not sure which is worse.
And we're not sure which is worse,
yeah.
Because neither suit really the purposes of the republic or the people for which it stands.
The question that I never really heard a good answer to until this past week, and of course when I came home after reading this this essay and said, Sharon, I think I understand what's going on there, and she just kind of nodded and said, yeah, I mentioned that to you a couple of years ago.
Go lay in your mat.
Yeah, that happens pretty frequently in our relationship. She's very tolerant, and I appreciate that. It appears that in 2009. The government of Qatar approached Bashar Assad. Qatar, which has the largest exporter of liquid natural gas on the planet, and they've got a huge gas field on the west side of the Persian Gulf, approached them with the idea of a pipeline to supply natural gas to Europe by running the pipeline through Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Syria, and then on to Turkey. Now, the only non-U.S. ally in that loop would be Syria, of course.
right.
Now, the implications of running this natural gas to Europe is that it would have weakened significantly the stranglehold that Russia has on natural gas supplies to Western Europe. And folks that haven't been to Northern Europe in the wintertime, I'm reliably informed that it's cold there in the winter and that you need natural gas for heat, and that Russia has exercised that geopolitical tool in the past when Europeans weren't playing ball by, you know, raising rates accordingly or shutting off the pipeline, which he's done a couple of times to Ukraine. Now, Syria, having been a longtime ally of Russia, as you mentioned, was not really inclined to bite the hand that's been feeding him for a while and been talking about President Assad, and instead signed a memorandum of understanding with the governments of Iraq, which we helped put into place, and Iran for a new so-called Islamic pipeline that would go from the east side of the Persian Gulf, where Iran also taps into that vast pool of natural gas, from Iran through Iraq, through Syria, and then on into Europe, bypassing Turkey by going across the floor of the Mediterranean Sea. And it was not long after that that we saw the Arab Spring begin to develop in 2011. So shortly, about a year and a half after this memorandum of understanding. So that began to make sense to me. Now, again, Sharon picked up on this a couple of years ago. It only sank in through my thick skull just here a few weeks ago. That seems to have more explanatory power than this goal of supporting the right of people to live free of tyranny. Because if that were true, if that really was what motivated us, we would have thrown the Saudis over the side long ago. I mean, you know, they push walls over on top of homosexuals.
Absolutely. No, I think you and Sharon are very perceptive. My sense of things really is, if you look at history, geopolitical history, since about 1880 forward, you know, it's kind of like they say about the economy, you know, it's the economy stupid. And in this case, it's about the oil stupid. It's like the whole set of games that have been played between really what used to be called the great game in the 19th century between Great Britain and Russia. The great game of the 20th and 21st century really has been predominantly between the United States and Russia since World War II. But really throughout even that period before that, you had all these interesting alliances going back and forth. You had the Baghdad to Berlin Railroad that was created, you know, between the wars, and it was something that really it was actually before World War I, to correct myself. And that railroad was to move oil to Germany. And the British would have nothing to do with that. They did not want that to happen.
Right.
The British, of course, have been operating out of the what's called the Mackinder theory, which we've talked about before, and the idea that Eurasia is the true treasure trove of the world, and everyone else is in effect an island nation, and that includes the United States, it includes Britain, and that was the so-called understanding of the Great Game, and the Great Game. In our day, and has been again since World War II, is absolutely been between the U.S. and Russia, and it's been over the question of who controls the oil of the Middle East. And so, all of the statements that are made by both governments, it's not like one guy is the good guy and the other guy is the bad guy. The reality is that both regimes, both empires, the Russian Empire now and the United States Empire, both intentionally mislead their citizens to try to corral support for ultimately what they perceive to be in the best interest of the people, which is to have the economic to have economic dominance. And so clearly, President Obama is telling the American people, just as George W. Bush before and George H. W. Bush before and Bill Clinton before, that it's all because of the cause of freedom and justice in the American way. But the reality is, of course, it's to support the economic system that keeps the rich people rich and makes the trains run on time, to use the old cliche. And that's what, you know, really drives us and motivates us. And for the Russians, it is a similar issue. It's a question of how do they preserve their economy. They know their manner of government and their manner of industrialization is not as high tech and as savvy as ours. They've known that all along. Nevertheless, they, like China, are able to overwhelm problems with just the sheer masses of human resource that they have. And of course, so anyway, the long story short there is that it's still about the oil. Both sides are misleading their peoples. And the real question is where is this going to lead? Now, I argue in my articles that the U.S. has effectively misunderstood and that President Obama and his advisors have misunderstood what has been the strategic geopolitical axiom of the last 250 years, which is that really since the Treaty of Westphalia, which ended the 30 Years' War, I guess back in the 18th century, 17th century, it's really at that time forward, it's always been about the balance of power, that one needs to have enough force in the area to keep the other guy from wanting to go to war. And we see that displayed very effectively in South Korea. If people stop to think about why is it that we have 40,000 American troops in South Korea? Well, it's to keep the North Koreans from becoming adventuresome and crossing the 38th parallel.
Right.
And if we had kept, son of a gun, if we had kept 40,000 U.S. troops somewhere in, let's say, western Iraq, it is very unlikely that ISIS would have become what it has become, and it is even more unlikely that Russia would have come to the aid of Bashar al-Assad. And so the same balance of power theory would have held, but instead our government became, I think probably to some extent, so enamored in believing its own public relations that we are the most powerful military in the world, and that the Russians are too tied up with their own problems. The price of oil's down, the ruble's crumbling, no way that Putin is going to become adventuresome and try to exploit the opportunity in the Middle East. But guess what? He didn't get the memo. He decided that it was time to exploit the opportunity. And so he had a clear there was a vacuum that had been created by the U.S. decision to completely vacate Iraq. And which, by the way, you'll notice that the U.S. is not so sure that it's going to do the same thing in Afghanistan, because right. Perhaps in this case, the president did learn his lesson, and that there needs to be an ongoing balance of power. But for all intents and purposes, we have lost the opportunity. We are out of there. What we are doing now in terms of U.S. airstrikes is actually doing nothing but helping Assad, and it's helping the Russians. We are out of there, and we have lost, in effect, for the time being, and perhaps for a long time, we have lost the Middle East. Certainly, we talked about Saudi Arabia earlier with the Shia Houthis on the south side of Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. The fact that the Fertile Crescent is being galvanized. I'd use balkanized, but that's almost a pun, across the northern regions of the Middle East by Russia and the Shiites, that you have really now only Israel that is really left to serve as a potential ally for the United States. And guess what we decided to do during this administration? We've decided to alienate the Israeli government, Netanyahu, to the point where, you know, you got to really wonder, if I'm Netanyahu, can I really trust the United States to come to my aid, since they continue to impose upon me a two-state solution and all of the other challenges that they wish to, declare in terms of how Israel is failing to maintain parity or to allow the Palestinians to have, in effect, great opportunities and the two their state and so forth. So it's we are in a quagmire in the Middle East now, and it's because of a number of strategic miscalculations that we've made geopolitically and militarily. Mm-hmm. And for those of us like yourself and myself, and that we study Bible prophecy and we have been looking for some time for a certain scenario to come about, namely the war of Gog and Magog, Ezekiel 38 and 39, all of this all of a sudden snaps right back into place and fits the picture. It looks like that Russia has been hooked. It's being drawn into the Middle East. It is serving as the force that's rallying all of the Islamic nations together, very much as Ezekiel described over 2,500 years ago. And while it had become unpopular to think that Russia might actually be Gog of Ezekiel 38,
right.
The reality now is that it is it's the almost sure bet that Russia is Gog from the land of Magog, which really is the land north of the area between the Caspian and Black Seas.
Hmm.
So it's the situation has radically changed, And as I summarize in the article, the U.S. cannot win in Syria.
Yeah, it doesn't appear that we've got a good way going forward. And I'm glad you brought up the Ezekiel 38-39 scenario, because there have been some other developments in the news over the last couple of weeks that just add to the potential complexity and explosiveness of the situation. In Lebanon, it was reported that the government there has put its military on a war footing because they noticed some of the rebel groups in Syria apparently maneuvering possibly to open a new front in that war, you know, in response to Russia's entry into the Syrian conflict, you know, attacking into Lebanon, which is where Hezbollah is based. And, of course, Hezbollah is actively fighting in Syria on the side of the government of President Assad. But in the Golan Heights, an oil exploration company there has announced just about 2 weeks ago a major oil strike.
Yes.
They said that the strata of this strike is somewhere on the order of about 320 feet thick, which is about 10 times thicker than most producing oil fields that are discovered around the world. So we're talking about a major find that could supply all of Israel's energy needs. Now, the rest of the world considers the Golan Heights part of Syria.
Right.
So how does that complicate things?
Yeah, well, one would suppose that Israel is not planning to leave anytime soon. And of course, as you alluded to earlier, this whole issue of the pipeline and where the pipeline runs and so forth is that there is clearly a contest going on as to who can corner the market. The Russians, surprisingly supported the Iranian deal to the extent that it was surprising in that it would put a lot more oil on the market and drive the price of oil down further, which it has. But I think they're taking a long-term view. They're essentially saying we are going to become the dominant supplier of oil and natural gas. We already are a major supplier with over 50% of the production, I think, coming from Russia and about 25% from Saudi Arabia. But we're eventually going to become the dominating supplier. The rest of the world has to basically hook up their devices to our gas pump, and that's our plan. It is about being totally dominating the energy supplies of the Middle East. So that's clearly going on, and all of a sudden you've got Israel that has already found a major natural gas field, in effect, underwater in the Mediterranean.
Right, which Hezbollah has already said, no, this belongs to us.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so you're including now with this new find, which I don't know if it's really oil or if it's oil shale, but regardless, it is so significant that they're talking about easily supplying Israel's need for oil, and Israel would become a fairly significant exporter of oil as well. So you look at that and you kind of go, well, okay, so Israel may be the last holdout. And that's, you know, one of the reasons why I've speculated, along with some others, that these particular verses in Ezekiel 38, verses 10 through 13 that talk about Gog also having an evil thought to come up against the land of unwalled villages, which the traditional view is that, well, that's just still talking about Israel. And it might be. I go into depth in another exegesis analysis that I did of those verses to argue, no, that really is reflecting the daughter of Babylon, and then looking at in verse 13 where it talks about Sheba and Dedan, which is Saudi Arabia, and the Arab Emirates and those particular Arab states. Then the merchants of Tarshish, which really relates to Spain, to England, and to then the young lions, to the colonies of the New World.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at that verse, it's always been said, well, these different players are just basically they're providing a lame protest against the fact that Gog is moving against Israel. Well, that could be the scenario, but it also may be that Gog is attacking the United States, Saudi Arabia, and selected cities, perhaps, in Europe, to reinforce the fact that it is going to take the oil and it's going to have control of all of that. And so the spoil that it seeks to capture may be in Israel as well. And so you've got all of this kind of coming together, suggesting that that this is the overarching strategy of Russia, and it has been for some time, and it appears to be in alignment with what many have speculated for many years. In fact, really for almost 150 years, that Russia would be the head of this confederacy of Islamic nations, and it would ultimately move against Israel, and this would precipitate a massive war that would likely be the triggering event that would ultimately bring the Antichrist into play. And ironically, we may not have time to go into this, but in terms of the fate of Gog and the fate of the daughter of Babylon, this war may in fact expose the fact that both of them are going to be destroyed in a matter of days, weeks, a few months, and that is what Ezekiel 38 and 39 seems to say, in some mm-hmm. cases very explicitly.
The thing that I just don't think I would ever have lived long enough to see is Russia positioning itself now in with its entry into the Syrian conflict, with the press conference that President Putin had with the Patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church a couple of weeks ago, where the Patriarch declared this to be a holy war. Suddenly Russia, in going into Syria and attacking the rebel groups that have aligned themselves more or less against, more or less with one another. Sometimes there's a lot of infighting there. You can't really tell who's on which side right. at any given week. But they've allied themselves against President Assad. And as you say, Bashar Assad, his father before him, Hafez Assad, brutal men. But I think that part of the world, in order to have a stable government, you almost have to have that strong man at the top of the government system, Saddam Hussein, Hosni Mubarak, exactly. Muammar Gaddafi, and so forth. Right. And Christians had it a lot better under Assad and under Hussein than they've had since the United States went in and took out Hussein and then backed the rebels in Syria to try to take down Assad. Suddenly, Russia is positioned as the defender of Christendom, not just in the Middle East, but for all of Europe.
Yeah, it really is another aspect of the great reversal that all of a sudden you've got the U.S. supporting revolutions indirectly to try to force regime change of these autocratic strongmen, and you know it is just as it was written in Alice in Wonderland, it's just curiouser and curiouser, yeah. You know, what really is going on and what's driving this. But it, as I said, it's misleading. Our president and the administration is misleading the public in terms of what's really at stake. And it's not just about freedom and democracy. It's about economic control. It's about blocking the Russian moves. And you know, the idea that we are there to eliminate ISIS is absolutely not true. We have made moral decisions that we are not willing to put a premium on protecting Christians, right. You know, or other, let's say, moderate Muslims from the radical extremists, that it's better for us over the long term to have those groups continue just to foist regime change in Syria. And so it's, you know, it is an absolute mess of our own making. And it's not only a military disaster, it's a great moral failure on the part of our country.
Yeah.
And this does not make Putin necessarily the good guy or
no.
the hero.
No.
You know, it's both sides are evil in what they're attempting to do, but it is the cold, hard reality of the world we live in. And the only thing that can really free us would be to actually have the truth and to make decisions as a people that we're not going to stand for this kind of foreign policy any longer. But we are a long way from having that kind of resolve.
Yeah, it is truly disturbing as we look at what's going on over there. It was only last year, 2014, when the major media suddenly sat up and took notice and realized that the Christian communities across the Middle East had basically been destroyed. But as and I forget who wrote this article, might have been in the New York Times. They said that for the Christian communities in what used to be Assyria, the Assyrian Christians,
right.
Last year with the rise of the caliphate of the Islamic State was just the culmination of 10 years of hell, which began when the United States decided to invade Iraq and took out Saddam Hussein, who was essentially a secular guy, but he kept everybody pretty much under his thumb so that you didn't have these squabbling religious sects and tribal groups going after one another. And of course, once he was out of there was no restrainer in place anymore. And so the Christians have been catching the worst of it for a decade. And we finally, the media finally noticed last year, in my opinion, only because they wanted to try to whip the American public into into supporting boots on the ground again. Mm-hmm. For our own geopolitical ends. So what we've accomplished after, 12 years in Iraq and 14 years in Afghanistan is we've basically eliminated the Christian communities that used to exist there in that part of the world. We've resulted in literally millions of people displaced. 4.5 million in Syria was a figure I just read the other day. Probably that many in Iraq as well. And of course, this flood of refugees heading for Europe and the United States, which I think it's a pretty safe bet that included among those groups are people who don't really intend to assimilate. And at worst,
that's a safe bet.
Yeah. And at worst may in fact intend to cause destruction in the, wherever they land.
That's right. It's really, if you look at it from a sort of from an ideological perspective, it's ultimately what you might call the death of liberalism. And by that, I mean liberalism in a classic sense in mm-hmm. which you're dealing with sort of a secular mindset that says we're not going to be dogmatic. We're not going to, believe in Christian dogma. We're not going to believe in Islamic dogma or Judaic dogma. We are strictly secular. We are liberal in our thinking. And so what's really happened is that we are so quick to be politically correct, but political correctness and, in effect, the liberal mindset has been the most effective means possible for destroying the institutions of the Western world. And now it is ready to come home to roost because now, essentially, under the banner of, well, we're going to give these poor refugees a chance to have a better life, and no doubt many, if not the majority, that's truly what they seek.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of its impact upon the institutions of Central and Western Europe, and potentially, if the Lord tarries, within the next 30 to 50 years in the United States, you're looking at utter chaos and the destruction of the kind of stability, the peace and tranquility that we want, that our Constitution talks about, and we've created these things because of our failure to in effect have let's be honest, a more biblical perspective
yeah.
on dealing with evil and corruption, and we've really been dominated by our economic issues versus humanitarian issues, yeah. truly humanitarian issues. And so it's coming home to roost.
Yeah. And it's not even about trying to control our own sources of energy. We've got plenty in Western North Dakota and in Southern Illinois. In fact, just before we relocated here to the Ozarks, there was a lot of excitement among the Southern third of Illinois, especially the southeast quadrant bordering on Kentucky and Indiana, because the geology there apparently is very similar to what's in Western North Dakota. And if that's the case, and there's a similar amount of oil there, we've then got, whatever the proven reserves of our Saudi Arabia, multiply that by about six. And that's what we've got in the United States. It's just yeah. more expensive to exploit it. So this policy that we've embarked upon with our allies, in air quotes, the Saudis, mm-hmm. is to essentially drive many of the shale operators who could provide for our energy independence out of business again.
Right.
Because yeah, they can't. It. Yeah. I mean, it takes about an $80 price per barrel to make the shale in southern Illinois and western North Dakota profitable.
Right.
But it's not the game isn't about providing for our needs. The game is about controlling what everybody else gets to use.
Yeah.
And that's
That's essentially the same thing that happened back in the 1970s. When those of us that are old enough remember the gas lines at the pump and gas lines extending out to the street and going around the block and so forth. But it was the same tactic to in effect crater the price of oil to put out of business the domestic oil producers and to force us to stay connected to and dependent upon foreign oil.
Right.
And so, yes, you're absolutely right. The same kind of long-term strategy of the Saudis and really of the Russians is in play here. And despite the fact that we have very likely a sufficient fossil fuel resources in our country, we're not able to develop those and to exploit those because of the price.
Yeah.
And now, the other thing, too, that we haven't really even talked about is beyond all of this, there really is this thing called the New World Order. And there really is the reality that the American leaders, whether we're talking about the the leaders that are in the White House on Capitol Hill, or whether we're talking about the shadow government of the George Soroses of the world, we're dealing with leaders that really believe in the concept of a new world order, and they have been espousing that and working towards that for over 100 years, and it's running right into the face of the Russian desire, of Putin's desire to build back the Russian empire. And so from a real strategic perspective, that really is the other confrontation that's going on. On the one hand, you see Putin and 150 leaders around the world coming together to talk about world government at the UN in the month of September, just a few weeks ago. And then on the other hand, you still see this clash of, you might say, jockeying for position over who really is going to run the New World Order. Is it going to be the Vatican? No, not really. Is it going to be the United States? It has always been thought that it would be, but maybe not. New book by Joseph P. Farrell that talks about how Germany has been so blasé about supporting the war, you might say, the revolution or the rebellion in Kiev and in Ukraine, that it really is just biding its time, and supposedly Putin is too, that the plan is to ultimately weaken the United States through its economy, through its economic failure that they hope to achieve. And Europe become once again the natural leader of, Germany, the natural leader of Europe, and that Putin gets along very well now with German leadership, and they could, in effect, create an alliance that that actually does create the New World Order. Hmm. So it's possible that that the thesis of the Final Babylon, that myself and Doug Krieger and Dean McGriff put together, that we may have to change the title to the penultimate Babylon, meaning that it's the second to the last. The real final Babylon may be a new world order that once again somehow Germany and perhaps portions of Russia, other portions of Western Europe may somehow come together in sort of in the post-American era. That may either happen just through economic collapse, or it may happen as a result of confrontation between Russia and the United States that I believe is hinted at in the passage in Ezekiel we talked about earlier.
Mm-hmm. Well, ultimately, however this shakes out, it, as I said earlier, is just the shadows of the real war that's taking place. The principalities, powers, thrones, dominions that the Apostle Paul wrote about, they are the ones who are motivating the human actors and the headlines that we read each day. So,
very true. Very true. It's a series of articles that I've written that are this one that we talked about, Pick Your Poison. The U.S. Can't Win in Syria is at my website, which I'll go ahead and plug, which is faith-happens.com, faith-happens.com. But there is also an article couple of articles. There's one that's the longer version of an article that I wrote for Prophecy Watchers magazine that deals with this very topic that you're talking about. There was an article I wrote called "Is Gog Just a Turk?" And my point being is the answer is no. You know, it let alone the idea of Russia versus Turkey as the as sort of the confederating force of the Islamic nations and moving against Israel. But it is that there is a supernatural power that was talked about. Certainly, power is talked about in the scriptures. We think in terms of Daniel, where he talks about the prince of Persia. He talks about the prince of Gracia of Greece. But interestingly, the prince of Babylon is not talked about. And it leads me to speculate that the true prince of Babylon, as well as, in effect, the prince of Tyre, the king of Tyre, may be, in fact, none other than the chief principality in power, which is Lucifer or Satan himself. And it would make sense in terms of the scripture, the fact that Ezekiel 28 talks about the king of Tyre, and that there is everybody looks at that and says, well, that's really a description of Satan. Well, it could well be. And of course, we make a lot of that in the book, The Final Babylon, connecting the dots between the prince of Tyre, the merchants of Tarshish, Phoenicia, the Carthaginians, and ultimately the merchants of Tarshish in the United States, that there is it's very easy to connect those dots if one understands what happened in ancient history and how eventually that migrated to the New World. And so anyway, so back to the principality and power. So it, you know, that is ultimately where we're headed, is to whoever is the prince or the power behind Babylon, which I believe is Satan, that that the final Babylon will be empowered by that that principality. And of course, I argue that is already underway at this time.
And as we watch the forces on the ground in and around Israel, things taking place to the east in Iraq and to the north in Syria, concerns about what might happen with the Jordanians and you know, the threat that they may face from the Islamic State. Right. And of course, as we record this in late October of 2015, the what appears to be a new intifada taking place in Jerusalem itself. Ultimately, the prize is going to be for the cosmic mountain there, Zion.
Right.
That is what is, this is all prelude to that final battle, you know, the Har Moed, what we see in Revelation as Armageddon, but the final battle there for Jerusalem and Mount Zion. So,
yes. Well, I guess just, I know we're about out of time, I guess probably my parting thought would just be that we are at a real watershed point in history in our lifetimes, Derek, in terms of what's happened. The United States has been a dominating, controlling force really since World War II in the Middle East, arguably before that, Britain and America together. That is changing. The power of that area now appears to be Russia, and it appears to be the Shia, stretching from Iran all the way to Syria. That is an enormous change in balance of power shift, and that has enormous repercussions upon the future of our nation and what's going to happen in this world. And so it is the most significant event since really, I would say, the time of the Korean War. Mm-hmm. More significant than Vietnam by far. It is the big event that ushers in the possibility that that we are right on the cusp of the very last of the last days.
Yeah. And of course, again, getting back to the Islamic State, the counter move by the United States and our Western allies to this growth of this Shia crescent across Mesopotamia was to cultivate the growth of the radical Mahdist Sunni group, the Islamic State. And the problem with you aligning yourself with a rabid dog is that you can't control who the dog bites.
That's right.
Yeah. Doug Woodward, the author of the new article, Pick Your Poison, the U.S. Can't Win in Syria, that's posted at his website, and I'll put links in the show notes to where you can find not just the website, but also that particular article. And Doug's latest book, Is Russia Destined to Nuke the U.S.? Brother, if we don't see you soon, we'll certainly see you next July in Colorado Springs, but hopefully being just a few hours away down the interstate, maybe we'll get a chance to see you face-to-face before then.
Oh, I hope so. We certainly have many more things to talk about and another new book that that I hope to introduce to you and to your audience in the weeks just ahead.
Very good. We'll talk again. In the show notes at vftb.net, a link to Doug's website, faith-happens.com, and the article, Pick Your Poison, the U.S. Can't Win in Syria. Again, Doug's latest book, Is Russia Destined to Nuke the U.S.? Hoping the answer to that question is no. But things are getting really bizarre in Syria as the proxy war continues, where Russia, using its air power to back Syrian and Iranian ground forces, also Hezbollah troops in their push in northwestern Syria to try to take Aleppo back from the rebel groups that are holding it. And again, Aleppo only about 25 or 35 miles as the crow flies from Dabiq, the town where the Islamic State believes a climactic battle is to take place against the forces of Rome, Christendom. So things are getting really, really weird over there. And those rebel groups, by the way, that Russia, Syria, Iran, Hezbollah are attacking are being supported by the United States and Turkey through these strange weapons drops that we've resorted to. You know, just dropping pallets of weapons and ammunition into the desert and hoping that the right guys get their hands on it. It sounds insane, but that's essentially what the United States is doing. Now, the Syrian or the Saudi government made a statement earlier this week that indicates how seriously the Saudis take this. The foreign minister had a message for Tehran, and I quote, "We wish that Iran would change its policies and stop meddling in the affairs of other countries in the region, in Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, and Yemen." Of course, Lebanon is where Hezbollah holds shop. "We will make sure that we confront Iran's actions and shall use all our political, economic, and military powers to defend our territory and our people." In other words, the Saudis and their Sunni allies, Qatar and the United Arab Emirates, are not happy about the developments in Syria, Iran's active intervention there, nor are they happy about the nuclear deal agreed to between Iran and the West. And so the Sunni powers are essentially threatening direct intervention. Bloomberg News reporting this week also that analysts say the Saudi government will probably speed up the flow of cash and weapons to its allies in the opposition fighting to topple President Bashar al-Assad, who's also supported by Saudi Arabia's main rival, Iran. Skipping down, sending arms is dangerous in the medium term, according to one analyst, because of how easily weapons can fall into the wrong hands. It's hard to know who those wrong hands actually are because the U.S. has been airdropping ammunition and weapons over the last couple of weeks now since Russia entered the conflict because we don't want to risk, you know, basically trucking them in ourselves. So we're literally airdropping pallets of weapons and ammunition into the desert and hopes that the right guys will get their hands on it. Of course, Assad has been accusing the Saudis and other Sunni nations, states in the Gulf, Persian Gulf region, of arming those rebel groups, and they're right. And you know, like, again, the United States has openly said it's doing so. The next step, of course, in all of this is open military intervention by the Saudis and its allies. And in fact, one Saudi national who's a visiting fellow at Harvard, their Center for Science and International Affairs, wrote an op-ed piece for CNN earlier this month saying, quote, "The Saudis are going to be forced to lead a coalition of nations in an air campaign against the remnants of Syrian forces, Hezbollah, and Iranian fighters to facilitate the collapse of the Assad regime and assist the entry of rebel forces into Damascus." In other words, saying that they are going to have to intervene directly if they want to achieve the goal that they want. So we're talking about a more direct conflict rather than the powers in the region just sort of sending weapons to rebel groups. We may see the Saudi kingdom intervene directly. And again, we've already got Russian forces on the ground, Iranian forces on the ground in Syria, and things just getting a little bit dicey there, to say the least. And of course, as I mentioned with Doug, the strange against this backdrop, we've got the strange political drama taking place this past week with Hillary Clinton being called before the Congressional Committee investigating the events in Benghazi. But of course, nobody mentioning that what Christopher Stevens was doing in Benghazi was very likely overseeing or tracking weapons transfers from the former Libyan military to those rebel groups in Syria that we are now declaring an enemy of all mankind, the Islamic State. So just very, very bizarre. And while this is taking place, by the way, the Saudi kingdom isn't as stable as it has been in recent years. It appears that 8 of the 12 surviving sons of the founder of the kingdom are supporting a move to oust the king, King Salman. He just took over earlier this year. But Salman is 79 years old, and there are a growing number of reports out there that he's suffering from Alzheimer's. So we shall see. Apparently the 8 surviving sons, 8 of the 12, who want to see King Salman pushed out, are supporting Prince Ahmed bin Abdulaziz, who's the former interior minister. And King Ahmed, or Prince Ahmed, rather, is 73 years old. He's the brother of King Salman. But there is increasing pressure within the royal family to bring this power struggle to a head and get it over with. I mean, Salman inherited the throne at the beginning of this year, but he is apparently ailing, and there are forces within the palace there that are angling to have him removed. It's a kind of a difficult time for the Saudis to have an impaired leader in place. So one other thing I just want to touch on briefly, and that is the prediction that Planet X, even though it didn't arrive on October 7th, as one group predicted, is actually going to be here sometime in December. So, but again, since this word is being spread by articles posted at beforeitsnews.com, I wouldn't be too concerned. Beforeitsnews.com is not curated. There is no editor who's checking sources or fact-checking anything that's posted there. So we'll have to see something a little more credible before we really get concerned that December will bring the end of the world, at least from Planet X. Might come in other ways, but not from Planet X. One other thing to mention. We clearly have gone off the deep end. Glamour magazine has named its Woman of the Year for 2015, and it is Caitlyn Jenner. Guys, you have a problem with your choice here, because your Woman of the Year has extra equipment, not normally. Never mind. We clearly have, without the help of the Large Hadron Collider, we clearly have slipped into some sort of alternate universe where a man can be declared Woman of the Year. I mean, frankly, I'm surprised that feminists aren't protesting this. It's like, what? You know, the patriarchy doesn't have enough control. Now they're taking over our Woman of the Year awards. Coming up on A View from the Bunker this week, kind of a tradition here on this program, as we talk with your friendly neighborhood PhD, Dr. Judd Burton, about Halloween. This year, we'll focus on pop culture and why we seem so fascinated with virtual gore, virtual bloodletting. What is it about seeing the shedding of human blood on screen that appeals to us so much, and how should we as Christians feel about this? We'll talk about that. That'll be posted on Wednesday, October 28th. And then, assuming that we make connections and confirm this, would hope to be able to bring you within the next couple of weeks discussions with Carl Tankrib, the chief editor of Forcing Change, online at forcingchange.org, who attended the Parliament of World Religions in Salt Lake City recently. A big gathering, very universalist. The only wrong doctrine is a doctrine that says it's the only right doctrine. In other words, Jesus wouldn't have been welcome there. You know, I am the way, the truth, and the life, and no one comes to the Father except through me. Oh, how intolerant. Carl will give us his assessment of the situation there. And even though it's probably about 6 weeks later than it should have been, I'd like to get Aaron Judkins back to talk about the documentary film Finding Noah. And we're going to see if we can coordinate with one of the other principals involved in that film. The film was released October 8th, and we'll find out more about the movie, where you can see it or get a copy of it. Again, still need to confirm those two, the discussions with Aaron, with Carl, but hopefully we'll get those for you within the next couple of weeks. Posted a new Gilbert House Fellowship this morning. Sharon and I, every week, go through several chapters of the Bible, going through it in chronological order. We're getting near the end of the book of Deuteronomy. We're into the final chapters that chronicled the life of Moses, and he's giving final instructions before the Israelites, led by Joshua, cross over the Jordan River and begin their war on the Canaanites, and specifically the Kerem, or the decree of destruction given by Yahweh to the tribes of giants who lived in the hill country over in Canaan. Today we talk about the blessings and curses God promised the Israelites, depending on how faithful they were in following his commands. So you'll find that every week posted on Sundays, usually by mid to late morning, at gilberthouse.org. That's gilberthouse.org. This coming Tuesday night on Skywatch TV, it's part two of a five-part investigative series that we're calling Genetic Armageddon, how we are changing life on Earth through our science. And this discussion coming up Tuesday continues what we began last week with the co-authors of the new book, Dead Pets Don't Lie, Joe Artis and Donna Howell, who dug into what is really going into the food that we feed our pets. And the television, just a clue, the television commercials with guys in white lab coats don't necessarily mean that whoever's paid for the commercial is really making a product that is healthy or even safe for your dog or your cat. It's disturbing. If you missed it, last week's program, it is posted both at SkywatchTV.com and on the Skywatch TV channel at Roku.com. Part two coming up this Tuesday night, 9:30 p.m. Eastern time on Skywatch TV, which is airs on the Christian Television Network. If you have satellite television, it's Direct TV Channel 376 or Dish Network Channel 267. Also on the Glory Star Satellite at Channel 117. Follows our friends at Prophecy Watchers. Again, 9:30 Eastern, 8:30 Central, on DirecTV 376 or Dish Network Channel 267. If you miss it, you can see it later in the week at the Skywatch TV Roku channel, also the Skywatch TV YouTube channel. We appreciate your likes at iTunes and at Stitcher, wherever else you find us. We also appreciate our reviews, rather. The likes go to the Facebook page, which are look for the View from the Bunker page at Facebook, which is where you can discuss the topics raised during these programs. And we remind you that A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House and released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 international license. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod, www.incompetech.com. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert. This is A View from the Bunker.